This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hey, this is Sonal. You're listening to the Offscript podcast. On the episode today, we're talking to the man behind the Ig Nobel Prize. It's a satiric award that celebrates the research achievements that cannot and should not be reproduced. We're also talking about some of the little white lies that your parents told you growing up. And producer Roger Pryor is going to tell us if laughter is really the best medicine.
The Offscript podcast.
I'm excited about this, Sonal Rapani, because it's a real good get for you and producer Rog.
Yeah, I mean, this is one that we were talking about last week. As we do sometimes on the show, it'll come to us on the show, but we need to speak to this individual. Then somehow Rog makes it happen, which is absolutely brilliant. Now, before we get into this interview, I want to run through the Ig Nobel Prize. So this started in 1991. It's been running for 3 decades. Some of the highlights that I picked out from over the years, okay? I'm just going to read you some of the titles of these studies.
So Ig Nobel, essentially, what's the kind of strap line to what the Ig Nobel Prize is?
It's essentially a satire, in a sense, or a way to... The thing is, they're not necessarily poking fun. What they say is they're recognizing the research that first makes you laugh and then makes you think.
Okay, I like it.
Okay, so there is something about your first reaction where you think this is humorous.
Right.
But ideally, it's also something in which once you investigate a little bit further, you can see the sense behind it, or you could see something to it, essentially.
Okay.
And our guest, Mark Abraham, who started this, is a key advocate of that. And he'll explain exactly how some of these things that seem completely nonsensical to him are actually worthwhile and valuable, and why it's important that we celebrate them. But first, let's go through some of the ones that have happened over the years, some of the more bizarre ones that came across my bow. So 2002, this was from a Sydney University researcher. His name is Dr. Kruzelnicki.
Good name.
And he studied 5,000 belly button lint samples to conclude that lint was in fact a combination of clothing fiber, skin cells that were led to by the navel via body hair. In fact, he's quoted as saying, your typical generator of belly button lint or fluff is a slightly overweight, middle-aged man with a hairy abdomen.
So me, essentially. I mean, and you know what?
I don't want, I'm not going to ask you about your belly button lint.
I don't want to know. Sorry, son, but I do. I often have a chuckle to myself. I do find an awful lot of belly button lint.
Okay, well, thanks for that.
Sorry, guys.
TMI, too much information there.
Probably.
All right, so the same year, 2002, also featured the winner of a study that was titled thus, Courtship Behaviors of Ostriches Towards Humans Under Farming Conditions in Britain.
What?
I'm going to leave that one right there.
Right.
We're not going to get into that.
Fair.
1998, the award, the Ig Nobel, I should say, for medicine, was for the medical report titled A Man Who Pricked His Finger and Smelled Putrid for 5 Years. these are just the titles. This one is one of my faves, too. In the year 2000 in chemistry, there were a couple, actually. Chemistry was the discovery that biochemically romantic love may be indistinguishable from having severe obsessive compulsive disorder, which actually, when you think about it, makes a bit of sense,
doesn't it?
Right? And the public health in the year 2000 was presented to a team of researchers from Glasgow for their report that was titled The Collapse of Toilets in Glasgow.
So the collapse of toilets,
I didn't go into it. That's
right,
just the name of the research that was awarded. There was one in 2001. One in physics, which was presented to a professor at the University of Massachusetts for his partial explanation, not complete, but partial explanation of the shower curtain effect. Why the shower curtain tends to billow inwards while a shower is being
taken. Why is that? That's a good question, isn't it? Great question.
I'll have to look into that. Maybe for a future because you asked.
Why does the shower curtain love you when you're in the shower?
It's so annoying, isn't it? Just sticks to you.
That, I can get on board with that research paper.
Okay, we're going to find out. I haven't looked into that one beyond the headline, but we'll have a little bit of a deeper look into that one.
Loving that.
Just a couple more for you quickly. 2003, Interdisciplinary Research Prize was gone to a team at Stockholm University for their report, Chickens Prefer Beautiful Humans. That was the title of it. There was another one that year, and for physics, that was an analysis of the forces required to drag sheep over various surfaces.
My goodness.
I mean, it's just the whole point of reading you some of these headlines is just there's so much research that goes on out there. There's so much of it that makes you raise an eyebrow, but, you know, if you dig a little bit, if you think, it actually a lot of the times celebrates a level of curiosity that's important in, and a freedom of curiosity that's important in making big discoveries.
I love that. You've put it beautifully there. It's a bit like this show, I often think.
Nothing
Mark
like this show, is it, Chris?
A perfect guest for Off Script.
Now, Mark Abrahams is now the editor and co-founder of a scientific humor magazine, The Annals of Improbable Research. And at the time, though, back in 1991, he had just become the editor of a science magazine. So he's sitting there and all this research is coming across his way and he's meeting all of these scientists and he's just coming across thousands of ideas that just, you know, the reaction that we had to some of the research that we listed earlier. He said a lot of these people were doing things that were so surprising that your first reaction would be to laugh. And that's how it all sparked an idea for him. Sorry, I just want to apologize as well. There are some birds chirping.
All right.
Enjoy the ambiance with
we're
this.
We're back down at the tennis stadium once more.
Mm-hmm. But most of these people were almost completely unknown. And I kept thinking, this person's going to live their entire life and almost nobody will know they did this. That's wrong. Somebody should do something. And then I realized, well, we can do something small. So we started this, at that time, little awards ceremony. And the first few years it was at MIT. We picked 10 winners a year. And I had also been meeting some Nobel Prize winners who seemed to have a sense of humor about themselves. So I invited four of them to come be part of this first ceremony, and they did. And I mentioned it to some reporters that I'd been meeting. And then we put the word out on the internet, which at that point was much, much smaller, that the first annual Ig Nobel Prize ceremony will happen on this particular date. The tickets are free this year, but you have to sign up. And the tickets all disappeared instantly. And the day came and some winners showed up. The four Nobel Prize winners showed up. Big audience showed up, more people than would fit in the building. And it got a lot of publicity. And so the next year, we were able to do it on a much bigger scale. And that has simply continued through the years.
So it's grown year on year. The interest in it continues for good reason. I mean, we talk about it every year when it comes up. He said it's now a raucous event that takes place. And here's the thing, though. It sounds so simple. Oh, hey, this is kind of funny. Let's celebrate this with a good-natured sense of humor, right? Let me say, I've worked at a university, and I can tell you that there are a good number of professors and academics who are a precious lot of people.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I would imagine getting this kind of, for them to give it a massive tick of approval, it is going some.
Right, because let's look at the premise of this. At the surface, you're taking a group of people who have spent years of work specializing in a very certain field. I mean, getting PhDs, let's say, becoming absolute authorities in the field. And then you're saying, hey, we're going to point out this work that you've done that you took seriously and have a bit of a good-natured laugh at it.
That's poking fun at themselves.
It is, but I can imagine how I think it's surprising that it was so well received, I guess. So how do you strike the right tone for something like this, especially when you're bringing people who have won the Nobel Award, the highest honor in their respective field, to present to somebody that you're saying, this is a bit of absurd research. How is it not smug?
Very worried about that from the start. So we've tried to be very careful to make this a comfortable situation. Almost always when we pick somebody to win a prize, or sometimes it's a team, we get in touch with them quietly. We offer it to them. And if they want to say no, then that's the end of the story. And we don't tell anybody and we give it to somebody else. Almost everybody we offer it to says yes. And things became much easier a few years in when we finally came up with a clear way to describe it. You know, words can make a difference. What we were doing was really a little different from what anybody had ever seen. And it's, we're giving prizes for things that make people laugh and then think.
So the idea isn't a finger point and a ha-ha. It's more of a, let's acknowledge something that seems absurd at its premise, but there's actual value behind it. That, I think they finessed the language a bit, because in earlier years, you saw the phrase, achievements that cannot or should not be reproduced, which is a bit more direct, I think. He said they scan everywhere to find these. They've got journals. People send in nominations, he says. They get about 10,000 a year. Some people nominate themselves.
Wow.
Despite this, of course, there have been a few people. I asked him if there had been people that had been offended. He said, yeah, it happens. But for the most part, people are quite happy to receive it. And the reason he said is that publicity is really hard to come by.
Of course it is.
So these are people who are doing this bit of research, and all of a sudden they have this platform that's opening doors for them because all of the major news headlines are picking it up. And it's actually, again, once you dig beneath the surface, sometimes there really is something interesting behind it.
And of course, the Ig Nobel Prize has, again, come on our kind of radar after, what was it, an upside down rhino?
It was an upside down. Exactly. And I spoke to him about that. We will come to that. It was just last week where there were a couple. There was somebody who was in it for measuring, trying to devise the reason that facial hair might have actually evolved because to save people from face punches.
Right.
That was one that stood out to me. There was another one about clearing your nose. Oh. And then there was upside down rhinos. We'll get to some of the ones from this year as well. But I wanted to start with some of the older ones that I came across. Now, a piece of toast.
Mm-hmm.
You enjoy a piece of toast with butter?
Not so much butter. Peanut butter, I'm sold.
Okay, you don't just do a little...
No, I don't do butter.
All right. Well, if you were to let such toast with peanut butter on it or jam on it, whatever it has on it, slip from your fingers.
Oh,
just
a
clumsy moment. It always lands on the buttered side down, right?
No. It happens 100 times, and I do drop my toast quite a lot. 100 times out of 100, face down. Rages me. It's on my carpet at home, not here. It's on the tiles, and it's in the bin.
It's common consensus that this is what happens. And in 1996, a physicist by the name of Professor Robert Matthews decided he was going to test this scientifically. He had kids drop, and I kid you not, 21,000 buttered toast. I mean, that's commitment.
That
21,000 is his sample size he's going for here. He wins the Ig Nobel in 1996 for this study because he did find, in fact, that toast will land butter side down most of the time, 62% of the time.
Wow.
Which is slightly less than you would think, but it's enough of a difference that it is a majority, I guess you could show. And he described this buttered toast study as a bit of work I did in my spare time when there was nothing on the telly. So I asked Mark what he made of this particular study.
It's both nothing and everything. So what's the impact if you're only thinking about toast? Not very much, unless you happen to be madly in love with toast. But once somebody started to look at, is this true? You know, everybody who eats toast has at some time heard this story that if you drop it, it's going to fall on the side that has the butter or the jam or whatever you put on the toast. And here somebody decided, well, I'm going to look at this and I'm going to test it. And I also know a lot about physics, so I can look at this, at the theory of this, at the physics of this, and see if it's true. And you discover that, yeah, more often than not, it does fall on the buttered side. And why does that happen? And he started to look at the physics of it, and then started to really think about, how does this connect to other things? And it connects in a way that's usually called Murphy's Law, this idea that if you're doing something and there's a possible way it can go wrong, it will go wrong. And that's connected to all kinds of things, including every kind of engineering. Anytime anybody designs a building or a teacup or a car or anything, most of what they're doing is trying to anticipate all of the ways that something could go wrong. Because if you're an engineer and you don't anticipate the ways things can go wrong, and those things do go wrong, because they will go wrong, your thing is going to fail and your career is going to be over.
So Noni Edwards from the ARN News Center overheard us talking about buttered toast and how it falls in the office earlier. And she just comes up and says, are you talking about the perpetual motion machine? And I'm so glad she did, because I somehow had never heard about this. It's called the buttered cat paradox. It's a bit of a common joke based on the common understanding that a cat will always land on its feet.
Yes.
Right? Buttered toast always lands buttered side down. Two facts. So what happens if you attach a piece of buttered toast, butter side up, to the back of a cat, strap it down, and then drop the cat from a large height?
Don't do that at home,
two
please.
Two seemingly paradoxical things. What will happen?
I love
just a little bit of a joke. And people have turned it into advertisements and all sorts of things. And they kind of, they say that it will produce an anti-gravity effect. As the cat falls towards the ground, it will slow down and start to rotate, eventually reaching a steady state of hovering a short distance
that
from the ground.
That is the kind of conversations that we have at ARNHQ is what it is.
Talking about cats, let's discuss the 1997 award. It went to physicist Marc-Antoine Fardin for trying to understand if cats can be both liquid and solid.
Oh, my Lord.
Have you ever had a cat?
We have a stray cat that's kind of adopted us.
Yeah, and you probably notice it. Sometimes you look over and the cat is sitting in something, and somehow the whole shape of the cat has changed. So it fits exactly in that thing.
Of course, kind of flows.
Yes. Yeah. And so this was a physics professor in Paris who started looking at this, and it wasn't really a serious thing. This was just a thought he had that was kind of funny. And then he started to think about it, and he started to think about, well, what's the difference between something that's a liquid and something that's a solid? If you look up the definition in science textbooks, a lot of it has to do with whether it takes the shape of whatever is around it. And if you look at just the definition, well, cats fit almost perfectly into the definition of something that's a liquid. But of course, they're also solid. So this is kind of curious. So here you have something that costs no money whatsoever, and it was just a stupid kind of funny little thought. But the more he started to think about it and look into the details, the more he started realizing, you know, this also, it's a doorway into trying to understand what are liquids and what are solids and what's the border between, are there things where it's hard to say whether something is a liquid or a solid? And there are many things like that.
Come on then, what did the research paper show us, Sonal?
Well, he makes an argument. The paper is more of an argument that he's putting out using different equations and things to suggest that a cat could be, should be regarded as simultaneously a solid and a liquid due to their ability to adopt the shape of the container.
I did say to you, there is one of those Instagram pages, whatever it is, those ones that tend to produce viral content.
Yeah.
There was a cat that I saw on a video,
yeah,
and it's spending too much time with you and Robbie that I'm watching cat videos.
I know, the fact that you're confessing this right now is brilliant.
I'm shaking my head at this. But there was a cat, and I watched about 10 times, because the cat that goes, you know, the little crack at the bottom of a door?
Yeah.
Can I actually get
yes.
to, did you see the same
I
video?
I know which video you're talking about.
A cat standing, and then all of a sudden it goes through this little crack at the bottom of the door and out the other side.
It's insane. It's like a liquid.
That's a liquid cat.
It is, definitely. I think it applies. Now, I really want to get to this last one. Andrei Gim from Russia remains the only person to have the amazing distinction of winning both an Ig Nobel and a real Nobel Prize. Now, I want you to tell me which one of these won which, all right? Don't look at the notes.
I'm not looking
at
notes.
Okay. There was one for studying the residue of pencil material pulled apart with scotch tape.
Right.
And another for discovering that you could levitate a frog with a magnet. Which one's the Ig Nobel?
The Ig Nobel is the frog in a magnet.
You are right. Let's hear about it a little bit more from Mark.
Somebody who's doing two things that probably sound kind of foolish and crazy and childish. The first time, it was two physics professors in Europe, and they used magnets to levitate a frog, which sounds like something impossible. And almost every physics professor in the world would have told you this is not possible. But these people tried it, and they discovered that, yeah, if you have a big magnet and you set the magnet up in a certain way, you can levitate a frog or almost anything else, even a drop of water or a strawberry or something. You could levitate a person if you had big enough magnets. They won an Ig Nobel Prize in the year 2000 for that from us. 10 years later, one of those same professors won a Nobel Prize, also in physics, for something that sounds even a little crazier. He was doing something that most little children try. If you've ever taken a pencil and you scribble with that pencil on a piece of paper, and then you take some sticky tape and put it on, you get this gray stuff, and you kind of flex the tape and little bits of it fall down. That's what they did. And then they put it under a microscope, and they discovered that they had the first known samples of a substance called graphene. Graphene is the two-dimensional form of carbon. Chemists had known for a long time that this must exist, but nobody had been able to get a sample, because it's really difficult to get a sample, until this professor and one of his students, one night playing around, got a sample. That has now become a source of not only research, but whole industries have started up around the world. And there are lots of people who believe that this substance, graphene, now that they have some and now that they are figuring out what it can do and how to use it, that they keep coming up with new uses. And an awful lot of people believe that over time, this might be the kind of thing that, like, silicon changes everything. You know, silicon is now the basis of most of our computers and a lot of other stuff. But 50 years ago, not many people used silicon for much of anything. People think graphene is going to have the same kind of wide-ranging effect.
This is actually, as I looked into it, a much bigger discovery than I could have imagined. It all started, they were trying to isolate the graphene, try to get it into a single two-dimensional layer, but they couldn't do it. They were trying all these fancy scientific methods. Somebody sees a bit of scotch tape with some of the sample on it in the waste paper basket, and that's when they decide to study it, and lo and behold, that was the thinnest layer of it that they had ever found, just on a piece of scotch tape that somebody saw in a waste paper basket. Wow. And as a result, because of its unique structure, I mean, it can carry 1,000 times more electricity than copper. It also is the thinnest material in the known universe. It was 150 times stronger than an equivalent weight of steel.
Wow.
The strongest material ever measured. It's as pliable as rubber and can stretch to 120% of its length. I mean, this is an incredible material. They're thinking about it as a replacement for silicon. So it's a crazy, crazy discovery from some scotch tape in a wastebasket.
And from a fellow who won the Ig Nobel Prize 10 years prior to the big discovery.
For levitating a frog, which I also think is pretty cool, to be honest.
But, of course you do, Sonal.
The Offscript Podcast.
We were debating this in the office today about the little white lies that your parents told. And when I say little white lies, little lies that don't really harm you all that much, but they foster this idea that, well, you believe everything that comes out of your mum and dad's mouth. Those little things that stayed with you. Tom Harvey, a little earlier, one of our regular listeners, who said that when he was a little nipper, the ice cream van, and his mum and dad would tell him that when the music is playing, that means that the ice cream man or lady has ran out of ice cream, which is exactly what my mum did when I was a wee nipper as well. You know, someone as a kid, I was a bit cheeky, I was a bit naughty, and I would always pull faces. So, and I think this one will chime with a lot of you, I'd always go cross-eyed. And my mum used to hate it in any photographs, you know, like say cheese.
Pull a face.
There'd always be me going kind of cross-eyed, you know, when you put the two eyes looking towards your nose. And my mum would be livid. And she used to say, and perpetuated this for a long time, to the point I actually asked a friend of mine, is there truth to this? And he kind of laughed, that if you do that and the wind changes, your face will get stuck. Your eyes will get stuck in the kind of cross-eyed.
You didn't go for that, though.
You know, as a kid, you're like, whatever, mum.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But part of you's like,
I'm never doing that again, ever.
You will. As she says it, you quickly go back to a normal face, because there is that little doubt there that she might actually be telling the truth. But that one always sticks out with me. But there's loads, and we're getting loads of messages coming in, and this will chime a lot of you. We'll be there soon. Are we there yet? We'll be there soon. A couple of more minutes when you know fine well.
Yeah.
4 hours.
To go.
You know, we'll be there soon. What does soon mean?
So I had none of this in my life. My parents did not tell me any little white lies.
Come on.
Yeah, no. None of this happened in my life. There was no...
Even about the big fella in red?
Nope. That didn't happen. Nor did the other fairy with the dental features.
Wow. That is... The fairy with the dental features. Is that what you've just said? Live on the national.
Moving on. Anyways, none of those lies came my way.
Never perpetuated them.
Mm-mm. No,
really?
if my mom was running late, so I remember one day when she picked me up from school like 2 hours late, there was no kind of making excuses. She was like, well, I got a phone call. You know, everything was very direct.
Okay. So
and to your face. Yeah.
I like that, though. That's why you're an honest...
Sometimes a little bit too honest.
A little too honest at times.
The Offscript Podcast. Setting the record straight because you asked.
Right then, Sonal Rapani and myself, Chris McCarty, in the lounge position. Why? Because, well, Roger's doing all of our heavy lifting. What are we discussing because you asked this week, Roger?
We are discussing laughter. And this comes from yesterday when you were talking about the myths and things that
are kind of true.
Well, so like a carrot lets you see in the dark. One of the ones I thought on the way home, I thought, is laughter the best medicine?
You thought about that on the way home?
I thought that on the way
this
home.
This show actually made you think. I love it, Rog.
Every night it makes me think.
About what on earth am I doing? Where's my career
exactly
going? What am I working with these numpties? Is that what you're thinking?
No, it's never even crossed my mind.
I'll let you off. Right then, is laughter the best medicine? Give me the science behind it, Rog.
Well, I thought we'd sort of set the scene a little bit before we go to the news, because we're fast approaching that. And over years of studying laughter, there's been a lot of scientific scientific study into it. It's linked to physical, emotional, mental well-being, even our relationships. And it's all inconclusive because it's so subjective.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, there's laughter that makes you cry. There's laughter that you do in rage. There's laughter that people do when they're nervous, all that type of thing. So it's quite interesting. But we will come to whether it is or isn't the best medicine. First of all, I just thought I'd look at what actually is laughter, okay? So we're talking about a physical reaction. This is like the definition of it.
Yeah.
That causes rhythmic, audible contractions of your diaphragm and other parts of your respiratory system. Specifically, your mouth and the nose, right?
The nose.
And the nose in the laugh is the difference between a real laugh and a fake laugh.
Oh, hey. Okay? This is intriguing.
Yeah, so studies have been done, and a massive majority of people who are able to tell whether someone is pretending to laugh or isn't pretending to laugh have said that the difference is that when someone's fake laughing, they're generally laughing with their nose.
Right.
Right. So if you ha 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 ha, you know I'm making it up. But if I was to be able to throw a bit of a nasal sound in there,
yeah,
I would sound more convincing as a fake laugh.
That's why is this? I'll throw this one out there as well. The older you get, I'm noticing a lot of my social group starting to snort. You know when they laugh?
Like, right.
That's so true. That only happens older, you know, like as you
like my,
age a little.
My missus starts doing it, and it's a big no-no.
But
what is going on?
I did not know we were getting a demonstration of that, but that was great.
Sorry, Rog.
At least then you know that it's a genuine laugh, because maybe her muscle control around her nose as she's getting a bit older is getting a bit worse. You know, it happens to the best of us. So if she's throwing a bit of a snort in there, then we know it's a real laugh.
It's good to know she's not faking it.
Exactly.
Well, there is that, but it's still weird. You know, it's like laughing. It's like, that was a decent joke, but when you're doing that, it just kind of puts me off.
Not that good.
Not that good, exactly.
So, primitive origins, laughter comes from a survival tool. It's thought to have evolved as like a way to bond socially with animals or the humans and express like that there's no threat and that you're in a playful state of mind. Study into laughter is, as I said, it's kind of ongoing. There's a lot of like unfinished theoretical work into laughing because it's just so subjective,
broad.
So broad. But here are some things that a lady called Sophie Scott from the University College of London has found out during her studies. I've kind of like focused it around what she's found out. So people laugh about 5 times in every 10 minutes of conversation with friends, which I think that's you've picked the right people if you're laughing five
yeah,
in 10.
I was going to say, you are. I've not got as funny a mate for that, I tell you.
Yeah. Come on, I would say you laugh more than that.
You reckon?
Yeah, I laugh with my friends more than 5 times in 10 minutes.
That's
I would say.
Good friends. You're also 30 times more likely to laugh with others than you are alone. Proof that laughter is infectious.
Absolutely it is.
This is coming around to that laughter yoga thing. Ladies laugh about 126% more than their male counterparts. I don't know how you get 126% more, but while men are more likely to instigate laughter. This is what Sophie Scott's found. So laughter comes in two shades. There's voluntary laughter, which typically features more activity in the frontal and motor areas of the brain associated with action planning and language,
right,
and spontaneous laughter, which includes greater activity in the deep instructions of your hypothalamus, which regulates basic physiological processes like hormonal balance. Researchers tested people to see if they could distinguish between spontaneous and voluntary laughter in people from 21 societies across 6 continents, and they found judgment to be surprisingly universal in terms of like what laughter is, what kind of laugh you're doing.
Can I ask both of you? Yeah, Sono, you, again, I've worked with you for 3 years. I should know the answer to this question. When you get nervous, do you laugh?
Yeah, I think I have a nervous laugh for sure.
Yeah, see, I was going to say, I think you do. Do you laugh when you get nervous, Rog?
Yeah, sort of it's a nervous laugh. You can tell I don't find something funny. You can tell I'm nervous. Yeah,
so I get.
I feel like you do too.
No.
No.
Not when I'm nervous.
Oh.
No. I've got a friend who I shall not name. He will laugh at the most, like, the worst times. We'll be at, like, funerals, etc. And because it's just the emotion of it all,
right,
he will start laughing. And it's become like a thing. What are you doing? You've got to step out. And he's had to. We're at a funeral quite recently where he had to actually step away because he was literally, he got a fit of the giggles at a funeral, for goodness sake. And, you know, friends know who he is and know that that's the way that he is. But
right. No,
when it comes to nerves, though, laughter is not something. If I'm nervous, laughter is the last thing
really
I'm thinking of. What I always think of you, Sono, as being someone that in a nervous situation, you'd have a little chuckle.
Yeah, when I like don't know what's happening.
Yeah, exactly.
It's my out.
It's your out, ha, 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 and then just back away.
Yeah.
Well, similar to the funeral thing, one of my most embarrassing moments was at a school assembly when something made me laugh, and I don't know what made me laugh, and I knew that I shouldn't be laughing. And then, but then, as Sophie Scott has found, if you start to tell yourself I shouldn't be laughing, this is the wrong situation to be laughing in, you then
worse.
Become your own laughter becomes infectious, and it makes it worse. So like the worst thing you can think when you know you shouldn't be laughing is I need to stop laughing, which is why that's probably your mate's problem.
Yeah,
I can't laugh.
Terrible.
Here. Too late. He's already gone. And that infectious side of laughter and its social quality means that even the thought of laughter can set people off, especially when they've already primed themselves with previous laughs, which is why comedians always insist on a warm-up act.
Yes.
Because the room's already been laughing together. They're more predetermined to have a good laugh when the main event comes on. So that's
interesting.
Makes so much sense.
It's not just to get an extra bang for your buck. There is a bit of science to that.
Exactly.
I love it. Right then, is it good for you? We're going to get to the bottom of that. And I think the obvious answer would be yes, of course it is. A good belly laugh is better than any medicine.
I think intuitively we all know that laughter is one of the best tools in our arsenal to deal with stressful situations. If you're feeling anxious, if you're feeling down, get your mates round, have a laugh, put a funny film on, it kind of works. But you'd be pleased to hear the science backs it up.
Good.
So we've been talking about a lady called Sophie Scott, who's done a lot of research into laughter for the University College London. And she's found that laughter, well, she and many people have found that laughter has been found to be a potent endorphin releaser. Of course, endorphin is a happy hormone and has an effect similar to antidepressants by also activating the release of serotonin.
There we go. So it is a good medicine.
Yeah, it is a good medicine. And the whole thing about it contagiously forming social bonds, it is, what's the word that we said earlier? Infectious.
Infectious.
It is infectious.
It is, there's no doubt.
The endorphin effect described above also explains why social laughter is so contagious, because spreading endorphin release through groups promotes a sense of togetherness, a tighter group, a better group of friends. It's like a Mexican wave of endorphins.
It is great.
Love that.
Yeah.
Love it.
Having a laugh with a bunch of mates, nothing better.
Exactly. It's good for your brain. Because not all laughter is the same, and because not the same things make us laugh, it forges different connections between different parts of the brain. We talked about spontaneous laughter being a bit more like the frontal lobe, and involuntary laughter being more inside the brain. The decision-making part of your brain. So that's a bit about the brain science, why it's good for you. It also protects your heart, you'll be pleased to hear. It has an anti-inflammatory effect that protects blood vessels and heart muscles from cardiovascular disease, or the development of cardiovascular disease.
I knew this show was good for my health. So panic.
Exactly. Researchers have determined that 15 minutes of laughter a day can help you burn between 10 and 40 calories, depending on your weight and how intensely you laugh. Listen, that's 10 to 40 free calories that you burn there.
That is good.
So just have a laugh. And keep laughing.
Just keep laughing. That is it.
Don't bother making it to the gym.
No. I mean,
exactly.
So you're looking at me here.
You know, you don't have to worry about it, you know, just hang out for 3 hours with us.
And just have a little chuckle and you'll burn all 40 calories just sitting in your car. Hopefully one or two of you have a chuckle now and again with some of the content that we give you. And listen, it's better than a workout.
Sure is better than a workout. One last one. Humans aren't the only animals that laugh. I think a lot of animals appear to laugh. And chimpanzees have been studied. And chimpanzees and other animals dissemble a similar pattern of voluntary and spontaneous laughter. So those two different types of laughter in humans. They use more controlled laughter to join in with giggles of other chimpanzees, and distinct spontaneous laughter in response to amusing events during play. Chimpanzees are more likely to laugh together. The longer they laugh together, the longer they play together, especially when that laughter is social rather than spontaneous.
So it's the idea that if you've got a funny fellow chimpanzee, you're going to stick around with him longer because he's a funny guy.
Form
love
a
it.
Good bunch.
Yeah.
I love that, Rog. Lovely little feature, that. So I guess the long and short of it is infectious. It's not the best medicine. Let's make sure that the solicitors are happy, but it goes a heck of a long way to ensuring you have a good day.
The Off Script Podcast.
We hope that you enjoyed this episode. Please do go ahead and click subscribe. You can also check out our other podcasts, Time Capsule or The Big Interview. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.